Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast, a production of Catholic Answers.
I hope that last week's interviews with David Bates about C.S. Lewis were a bit of a reprieve from what we're seeing in the news cycle. In fact, I was out of the office last week spending time with my family, my in-laws, but I wanted to make sure to comment on TrenthornPodcast.com that I'm disturbed to hear about the shootings in El Paso and Dayton, Ohio at the beginning of the month, claim 33 lives. And what's most disturbing is that this is a weird kind of new normalcy for us, like, oh, another mass shooting. And that's not the way things are supposed to be. And we should respond to this. But we should respond to hearing about these tragedies in an intelligent and compassionate way, which is what I try to do here on the Council of Trent podcast. And I want to be able to offer that to you so you can respond to others when they have questions about, well, what does the Catholic faith say about this? Or what should we as Catholics do about gun violence in America or violence in general? So to get started, I want to first show where our faith intersects with this issue, especially when it comes to being pro-life. There are people who will say it's inconsistent or it's hypocritical for somebody to be pro-life or, and quote-unquote, one area where this intersects with our faith is on the issue of being pro-life. There's people who will say that you can't be pro-life and quote-unquote pro-gun at the same time. Or if you're Catholic or pro-life, then you have to be for gun control. But they don't define what those terms mean, and so things get lost in translation when we try to have a dialogue about it, especially when you try to have a dialogue on social media, which is a terrible place to have dialogues. I have to dial back my social media behavior. My wife has called me out on it, and kudos to her. I have been sucked into the void more so than I should be recently. In fact, there are some people online that I'm not going to engage with in the future because I've shown that they are in error or they have incoherencies, and it would just be a waste of my time to engage them. I mean, I do debates in formal public settings so they can be of value to others. Debating people on social media, it doesn't have that much value. I want to share insights on social media, but getting into endless debates doesn't do anything. However, one debate that I saw on there is helpful for our discussion today. So Abby Johnson, who is a pro-life leader, someone who used to work for Planned Parenthood, now does not anymore. She's one of the nation's leading pro-life voices. She put out this tweet a few days ago. "I carry a gun. I have a concealed carry permit and jump through the necessary hoops to carry. I realize not everyone feels comfortable carrying a gun, but every law-abiding citizen needs to be comfortable protecting yourself and your family. Mark my words, it's gonna get worse." I don't know exactly what Johnson meant by saying it's gonna get worse, whether it's gonna get worse for people who want to be law-abiding citizens carrying guns, or there'll be more threats against people's families. I'm not sure what she meant. But Johnson got a lot of criticism for this tweet. I think one of the writers at America Magazine, I tried to find his tweet, he might have deleted it, said, "Oh, here's someone who claims to be pro-life, but is proudly pro-gun or proudly, you know, pro-gun violence." Like the gist of his tweet was that Johnson was irresponsible for claiming to be pro-life and saying that she carries a gun. How can you be pro-life when you say, "I carry a gun"? Well, Johnson's not saying she uses her gun to shoot innocent people. She uses it to protect her family. And I would not be surprised if Abby Johnson has gotten death threats. I know pro-lifers who have received death threats. I haven't gotten any death threats yet. Praise be to God. I do get a few messages every now and then from people telling me I should kill myself. And I just feel bad for those people that they would have the nerve to say that. To want to say that to another human being must mean that your heart is full of a lot of hatred and darkness. So I pray for those people whenever I get tweets or I get emails from these people saying the world would be better off if I, Trent Horn, ended my own life. But if you are a subject of threats and you feel the need to protect your family, you should be allowed to do so in a lawful way. So when it comes to the issue of being pro-life and quote-unquote being pro-gun, there's no inconsistency here. As long as you're not using a gun to shoot innocent people, as long as if you are pro-life and you kill innocent people, that would be hypocritical. But if you're pro-life and you're a soldier who's fighting in a just war, for example, or you're a police officer who has to shoot and disarm a violent subject who's threatening the lives of other people, there's nothing inconsistent about that. Though not all pro-lifers agree. I want to share with you a clip from the Reverend Robert Schenck. A few months ago, I did an episode here on the podcast called When Pro-Lifers Go Rogue. And it was about how Reverend Schenck is now, he's Protestant. His brother is actually a faithful Catholic priest. But a few months ago, he's come out and said that he's pro-choice. So I'm actually in favor of abortion. He's not in favor of making it illegal. So he's totally drunk the Kool-Aid. So I wanted to find online clips of people saying you can't be pro-life and quote-unquote pro-gun. And this I found from 3 years ago when the Reverend Robert Schenck, was still pro-life, but he was accepting more of these kind of liberal positions. And now I don't use the words liberal and conservative haphazardly. I try to keep this podcast relatively politics-free. I have my own politics. I will share them when I feel that it's okay to do that. But a lot of times I usually try to say things like secular liberalism, that secular liberalism is antithetical to our faith and what it proposes, a godless world that promotes sexual deviancy, sexual identity disorders like transgender identity. But more and more and more, it's hard for me. I see that not just within secular liberalism, but just within the political framework of liberalism in general, that I meet Catholics who identify as politically liberal or progressive, who eventually start to accrue all these problematic positions. And then later down the line, they overturn the whole cart and they give up things like being pro-life, which is what's happened here to the Reverend Robert Schenck. So here's a clip from CBS Sunday Morning. If the newscaster, the guy interviewing Schenck, sounds familiar, it's Mo Rocca, who was originally on The Daily Show, which when I first watched the clip, I was like, whoa, wait a minute. Is this like a spoof? Is there going to be a joke here? Because it's weird when you have someone who is a comedian now playing a straight, you know, straight-laced reporter. But I want to play you this clip from 3 years ago because it speaks for itself.
Who will ultimately save us? Christ or a Glock?
A man or woman who wants to defend his or her family legally owns a firearm in case someone comes into their home. How is that unchristian?
Well, first of all, you're making an immediate decision that if someone invades your home, they are going to die. So you are ready to kill another human being in your home. That brings about a big ethical question for the Christian.
All right, so I'll stop you right there. So that's Mo Rocca interviewing the Reverend Robert Schenck, who is saying that you can't, if you believe in using a gun to protect yourself, you're not really Christian. And his argument here is flawed because this ethical question, it is an ethical question, but it's one that was settled 700 years ago, even before that. But here's what St. Thomas Aquinas says about this matter. So Reverend Schenck is wrong here when he says that if I shoot somebody who breaks into my home and I have a reasonable belief they are going to harm me and my family, I don't want that person to die. I don't even want to kill that person. I just want to stop them from harming me and my family. And I have a right to do that because that's what it means to have a right to life. That having a right to life means you have the right to do things to protect your life. Now, you don't have the right to kill other people to save your own life. So, for example, if I'm dying and I need a heart transplant and Bob over there has a super healthy heart, I can't shoot Bob and take his heart and put it in my body. Of course, I need other people to do that, obviously. But the point is, I can't kill him to save my own life. But if someone is a threat to me or my family, I can neutralize that threat knowing that that act has more than one effect. There's the effect of saving my life and my family's life and the effect of the attacker dying. Then that's an effect that I foresee, but I don't intend. In Catholic moral theology, we call this the doctrine of double effect. This is how St. Thomas Aquinas puts it. Nothing hinders one act from having two effects, only one of which is intended, while the other is beside the intention. Now, moral acts take their species according to what is intended and not according to what is beside the intention, since this is accidental, as explained above. So Aquinas talks about the doctrine of double effect. And here in this section, he's actually responding to an objection. The question is it justifiable to kill in self-defense? Because the Bible says, thou shalt not kill. And what Aquinas says is, it is justifiable, and here's how he defends it. He says, accordingly, the act of self-defense may have two effects. One is the saving of one's life. The other is the slaying of the aggressor. Therefore, this act, since one's intention is to save one's own life, is not unlawful, seeing that it is natural to keep for everything to keep itself in being as far as possible. And yet, though, proceeding from a good intention, an act may be rendered unlawful if it be out of proportion to the end. All right, so what Aquinas means is you can defend yourself, you can't use more force than what's necessary. In fact, he says, wherefore, if a man in self-defense uses more than necessary violence, it will be unlawful. Whereas if he repel force with moderation, his defense will be lawful. So that makes sense that if someone breaks into my home, and let's say I just pump the shotgun, and he gets scared and he runs out the door and he's running down the street. If I shoot him on the back or the way out of my house, that's immoral. That's killing. That's manslaughter at the least, because he's no longer a threat to me. In that moment, I'm intending to end that guy's life. Now, if someone broke into my home, was going to harm my family, and I shot this person, and they're on the floor, and they're writhing, and the police come, and my family's safe, and it turned out that person survived being shot, I wouldn't be sad. I would be relieved. I'd be relieved, like, oh, I'm glad I didn't have to kill that person. I'm glad my family's safe. I would be relieved. And that shows that in killing in self-defense, the intention is not to end the other person's life. The intention is to stop the fatal threat. And so it's a licit and lawful thing for us to do. Whereas if you take something like abortion, for example, abortion cannot be justified with the doctrine of double effect. And the reason for that is because you intend the child's death. Like if you did an abortion on someone, and you told them, well, it turns out the child is alive. You're not pregnant anymore, but the baby's alive. The person would probably be upset. They would say, well, no, I wanted an abortion. I don't want a live baby. I want a dead baby. Because some people will argue that an abortion, the person doesn't want to end the baby's life. They just don't want to be pregnant. But if you told these people you can have end your pregnancy and choose whether the baby is alive or dead, they're going to choose ending the child's life. Because really, it's not about ending the pregnancy. It's that they don't want to be parents anymore. So let me play a little bit more from this interview and the interaction.
And we're told in the Bible, we're even to love our enemies.
Even a potential intruder, someone who comes into your home to hurt you?
Is it always God's will that I survive a violent confrontation with another human being? I'm not sure that's always God's will.
Schenck is not a pacifist, nor is he opposed to guns for hunting. The problem, he says, is civilians using guns for self-defense.
Well, here, I do not understand what the Reverend Schenck is talking about. If he's not, there has been a stream in ethical tradition, even some Christians embrace this, called pacifism. The idea is that you should never respond to violence against anyone. And I would say, though, that pacifism is an immoral philosophy. The idea that even if Hitler is rounding up people and sending them to concentration camps, you are simply to just lay back and do nothing. But here, what's happening is that, well, why is that? Well, because if you were to kill, you'd be committing evil. Well, no, as you already see with the principle of double effect, you're not committing evil. But even if that were the case, you're allowing greater evils to happen by allowing people to kill with impunity and doing nothing to stop them when lethal force is the only thing that will stop them. So here, what he's saying sounds a lot like pacifism. Is it God's will I always survive an encounter with an intruder? It may not be. It could be the case that I fight an intruder and the intruder wins. It wasn't God's will for me to continue living at that point. But that doesn't mean, because God can decide when my life is going to end, that means I have no say in the matter and I can't take lawful steps to protect myself and to protect others.
His conversion on the issue is the subject of the documentary The Armor of Light, airing May 10th on PBS.
Is that a pro-life ethic?
In it, we witness his disagreements with fellow evangelicals.
Don't own one, okay, Rob? You're afraid of firearms, don't own one. You're afraid
Troy,
of guns,
listen,
you leave them to other people.
You know,
I'm not
one of the reasons
guns.
That I'm afraid
I'm
of them?
I'm afraid of them.
Because I don't trust myself in the moment of crisis.
An armed society is a polite society.
It's a Disney movie, though not from the Disney you know. Director Abigail Disney is Walt Disney's grandniece. She's also a liberal supporter of abortion rights, who struck up an unlikely friendship with Rob Schenck.
So I was expecting a fire-breathing dragon. I was expecting somebody I really didn't like.
And how soon did those feelings lift?
Instantaneously.
Well, surprise, surprise. When this interview was recorded, Shank was still pro-life. Now, as of a few months ago, he's not pro-life anymore. See, that's what happens. The book of Proverbs says, as iron sharpens iron, so man sharpens his fellow man. I wish there was a counter proverb that you will dull the blade of your knife if you're with other dullards. Now, I'm not saying that people who disagree with me are all dullards or intellectually incompetent. My point is that when you keep bad company, it rubs off on you. And so when we have friends, we have other people who want to build us up. When we try to maintain convictions that the world hates, convictions like abortion is immoral, sexual activity outside of marriage is immoral. These are moral positions that the world hates, and it's hard to hold them in our world. So that's why we need friends that build us up, that strengthen us, and that when we start to move out, you see here that, oh, there's this unlikely friendship, and what a surprise, you know, you're starting to believe in their worldviews, eventually you just kind of get sucked into that. Now, that does not mean, however, that those that I disagree with, their positions are completely without merit. Father James Martin, on his Facebook page, republished an article that he wrote for America Magazine back in December of 2012. This was shortly after the Sandy Hook massacre. And this passage, I do give him credit. I disagree with Father Martin on a lot, but I actually do agree with this passage that he says here. When we face gun violence and mass shootings, what should we do? And so he says, our deeply felt revulsion over these crimes, our sadness over the violent death of young children, and our sympathy for family and friends of the victims is more than an invitation to prayer. Deep emotions are one way that God encourages us to act. Simply praying, God, never let this happen again, is insufficient for the person who believes that God gave us the intelligence to bring about lasting change. It would be as if one passed a homeless person and said to oneself, God, please help that poor man, when you could have helped him yourself. And the letter of James says something similar, that it doesn't do anyone good when you say, oh, go, be well fed, and you don't provide the person those means. It'd be the similar thing with abortion if we only prayed and believe that the only thing we ought to do to end abortion is to pray. And we should pray. Just because prayer is not the only thing we should do, it doesn't mean that it's not an important thing that we must do. It doesn't mean it's not one of the most important things that we should do. But that we also act when it comes to abortion. We make legislative proposals. We are involved in ministry and outreach to people who are abortion-minded, who are post-abortive. And we can do the same thing with gun violence. Now, where people who endorse gun control, where I think they go wrong here is they'll say, hey, you people who say you're pro-life, why don't you do something about gun violence? And then some of us will say, okay, well, here's what I believe would be a good step to reduce gun violence. And they'll say, what I mean is you need to take our approach. We need to ban guns. We need to do all of this. And the same thing happens when people accuse pro-lifers of being hypocrites for quote unquote not caring for the poor. People will say, oh, if you're pro-life, you only care about life before birth. I'll say, well, that's not true. I support this charity and I support this policy proposal to help the poor. Well, no. If you really believed in helping the poor, you would support this welfare program, this political program I agree with. I hate when people do that, when they say, you don't care about the poor, or you don't care about victims of gun violence because you don't support my specific policy proposal to help the poor or to reduce gun violence. We're all called to protect innocent human life, but we can prudentially disagree with one another about how to do that. What are ways that we can do that to protect people from gun violence? So what I want to do now is I want to go through some solutions people propose. I mean, I'm not an expert in this area. I've done some research, but I think it's important for us to talk about this issue and see what are practical things that can be done to reduce gun violence. So as I said before, this falls in the realm of prudential judgment. The church doesn't have an explicit teaching about what we ought to do to solve complex problems like gun violence in our country. It does teach that it should be illegal for us to use guns to shoot innocent people. But beyond that, we can debate different proposals. So let me go through a few of these right now. The first one that came up in the wake of the El Paso shootings that I think is not a very helpful policy is the idea that we should ban or reduce access to violent video games, saying that violent video games are the thing that cause mass shootings. And that's not a good argument. There's no evidence for that. I would direct you to Patrick Markey, who wrote a book called Moral Combat. It's a riff on the video game Mortal Kombat, which was blamed for violence in the late 90s and early 2000s. Here's a clip of him on Tech Insider talking about the claim that violent video games are a direct cause of mass shootings.
When we look at games like Grand Theft Auto and Call of Duty, the two games that tend to be kind of lightning rods that are often blamed for school shootings, we find that when those games first come out, there's actually sudden dips in homicides in the United States. We also have done other things where we look at when are people actually playing violent video games. So this is kind of across the board, any type of violent video game. And what we find is when people are playing violent video games, we also see dips in violent crime, aggravated assaults, homicides, and so forth.
So I won't be surprised that some people who engage in mass shootings or acts of violence might also be addicted to or play violent video games. But that would only show that people who are prone to acts of violence or to mass shootings like violent video games, not that violent video games are the direct cause and made them into that person. It may just be the case that a person who's violent will like something that is violent, not the case that something is violent will cause you to become violent. Now, I do think that, you know, we can have an entire other episode about violence in film, in television, in video games, and it desensitizing people, especially children. That's an important conversation to have. But here, I don't think it's the explanation for mass shootings, because you look at a place like South Korea, for example. People in South Korea play video games all the time. And many of them are very violent video games, but they have incredibly low rates of gun violence. The countries that have the most gun violence are, half of all gun-related deaths are in Brazil, the United States, Mexico, Venezuela, Colombia, and Guatemala. Those are not countries where a ton of people are playing Call of Duty. Well, maybe in the United States, but it's not about video games. That's not the big thing that makes a difference. The thing that makes a difference are guns. This should be uncontroversial. The reason we have a lot of gun violence in the United States is because we have a lot of guns. I mean, there's more guns in the United States than people. There's over, now it's hard to know how many there are for sure, but there's 330 million people in the U.S. It's been estimated somewhere between 250 to 350 million firearms in the United States. It's also the same reason when you look at traffic fatalities. Now, Africa, Liberia, places in Africa, they have the highest traffic fatalities, something like 35 deaths per 100,000 inhabitants. But the United States has twice as many traffic fatalities as New Zealand or Western Europe. We have 12.4 deaths per 100,000 inhabitants, one of the largest in the Western world. And that's because we have a lot of cars. We have a lot of cars in this country. We don't use public transit very much. A lot of places. Now, I love San Diego. Public transit in San Diego is awesome. But I've also lived in other cities where the public transit is terrible and people need cars. So just because, so we know, I think we can be very clear. The reason gun violence is high in the United States is because there are a lot of guns. That's just a fact. What you do with that fact, what you do when you put forward a proposal for reducing gun violence, that will involve a value judgment as well as a prudential judgment. Prudential judgment being a good, we can all agree, less gun deaths would be good. Prudence is the virtue by which we figure out the best way, the most reasonable way to reach a good. And so people will disagree about what is most prudential in achieving a certain kind of good. So immediately in the aftermath of these shootings, you'll have people who will say, we should just ban all guns. I just don't think that's realistic. One, I think people actually do have a right to bear arms, both constitutionally and legally. There's a great website, I'll link to it in the show description, by Timothy Asau. He is a philosophy professor, and he's a philosophy professor who has great stuff on sexual morality, and he just wrote a new website called Armed Academic, where he puts forward philosophical arguments in defense of the right to lawfully use firearms to protect oneself. But even if you didn't think we had a right to bear arms, if you didn't think people had a right to own guns, I just don't think that this is a practical solution. Once again, there are so many guns in this country. I don't see how you would be able to get rid of them. I don't even see how you would be able to pass an amendment that repeals the Second Amendment to the Bill of Rights. Not that you should. I think the Second Amendment, my interpretation of it, is that it deals with protecting the rights of individuals to be able to bear arms. That 9 out of 10 of the amendments in the Bill of Rights are about individuals and protecting the rights of individuals. Now, I don't think that the main threat of when you take away people's right to bear arms, that you'll have an oppressive government. I think that's something to seriously consider. But the thing for me, honestly, when people don't have the right to protect themselves with firearms, you lose the ability to protect yourself when a social safety net, when social order destabilizes. And that can happen with frequency. For example, when Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans back in 2005, I was reading an article in the New York Times where a guy was saying that it felt like living in a lawless land. There's no, you can't call 911. There's no police. The streets are flooded. Instead, there's armed roving gangs going through the streets, looting buildings, looting houses, killing people. This guy in the New York Times talked about that experience. He said he slept with a knife under his pillow because he didn't know if people would break into his home and kill him. And he had nobody to call. The phones are down and people are stranded. And, you know, I live here in San Diego. There could be a major earthquake and you're cut off from being, you know, from support, from law enforcement. So for me, that's the more realistic pressing need where one might need the ability to protect oneself if law enforcement is unable to do that. And once again, that's my opinion. That's not a teaching of the church. We're talking here about prudential judgments and what to do about gun violence. So I think that trying to ban all guns or even banning certain kinds of guns like semi-automatic rifles like the AR-15, I don't think that's going to make a tremendous reduction in gun violence deaths, because I'll talk about the history of mass shootings. Most of them have been done, many of them, some of the most, the deadliest mass shootings in U.S. history were actually done with pistols, done with handguns, not with semi-automatic rifles. Another suggestion that people put forward is having more armed good guys. If we had more good people with guns, they could stop bad people with guns. And intuitively, that makes sense. But here's the problem. It's not even. A bad guy with a gun is not on an even playing field with a good guy with a gun. And here's why. The bad guy with a gun has a ton of targets. He wants to shoot anybody around him. The good guy with a gun has to be skilled enough to only hit the bad guy with the gun. So the good guy with the gun has a lot harder of a job to do. He can't hit other innocent people or law enforcement. And what studies have shown, I'm reading an article here from ABC News, the FBI compiled its own numbers about active shootings where people with firearms stopped these individuals. The report found that in 5 of those incidents, armed individuals who were not members of law enforcement exchanged gunfire with the shooter and led to it being stopped. Only 5 out of 160 incidents. But in 21 of the incidents, an unarmed bystander using a chair or doors or just tackling somebody was able to stop the bad guy. In most cases, when you read about a shooter being stopped by a good guy with a gun, it's almost always, in every case, a member of law enforcement or military who is off duty. Because these people have the training. You could have a gun, you could go to the shooting range, but it's not the same thing as being constantly trained, knowing how to operate under conditions of taking gunfire from a hostile person. And so if you're not trained in that, it's way different when the situation presents itself to you in real life. I was talking to my wife, Laura, about this. She's a nurse. I said, it'd be like if you only studied nursing in a classroom and worked on a dummy, and then immediately you were thrown into the ER and had to deal with a gunshot victim. You'd be a completely different scenario, and you might freeze up because you're not used to that. So I think that having more law enforcement, not just trained security guards, people who are trained to use weapons to protect others, is one way that you can reduce gun violence. As long as they are properly trained individuals, typically they're going to be members of law enforcement or the military. But what I want to turn to now are 2 things that I think are overlooked in the debate over gun violence, and that is media coverage of gun violence and a lack of support for vulnerable people. So in 2016, the American Psychological Association published a book, Gun Violence and Mental Illness, and it said that serious mental illness only accounted for less than 1% of yearly gun-related homicides. But to me, one of the biggest things we're overlooking in the debate about gun control and gun violence is a lack of support structures for people who are vulnerable and thinking of turning to violence, and a presence of structures that encourages people who are vulnerable to turn towards violence. And in particular, it's constant media coverage of mass shooting events. So I went online and did research about mass shootings, and the traditional definition for a mass shooting is a shooting with a firearm that results in at least four people being killed. But the problem is a lot of these mass shootings where at least four people are killed, they're not mass shootings that you think of, like somebody who just goes out and is trying to kill as many people as he can. In a lot of these cases, they're botched robberies, they're domestic violence situations. So I wanted to look at the history of mass shootings involving at least a dozen people being killed. So when you go back in the history of this, you see an interesting progression in the frequency of these kinds of events. In the 20th century, there's only a handful. You have in 1949, Howard Unruh walks down the street of Camden, New Jersey, kills 13 people with a Luger pistol. 1966 at UT Austin, Charles Whitman kills 17 people with a sniper rifle. 1984, the San Ysidro McDonald's massacre, James Huberty killed 22 people. And all these, actually, when you look at the profiles of the people involved, they're people who have post-traumatic stress disorder. They were living sexually promiscuous or even homosexually promiscuous lifestyles and were battling depression. Charles Whitman was diagnosed with a hypothalamic tumor, the guy with the UT Austin tower shooting, and that he probably had some kind of a brain disorder that led to this. James Huberty, who shot people at the San Ysidro McDonald's, lost his job and was dealing with depression. Over and over, the Edmond Postal shooting, Luby's in 1991, Columbine, 1999. I remember that as a kid. I was in high school when that happened. In that, it says, quote, the FBI concluded that the killers were victims of mental illness. Harris was a clinical psychopath, and Klebold, so Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold, the Columbine shooters, these are vulnerable people who have a track towards violence. But I think in the past, notice here up till 1999, that's just about six mass shootings that end up with more than a dozen people being killed. Starting in 2012, however, there is a mass shooting every single year where more than a dozen people are killed. So what is the difference? These kinds of guns and these weapons have been around for all this time. What has changed? I think what has changed is that we've entered a time in history where people are at their most isolated. They think that their Facebook friends and their Twitter friends are their real friends, that people on 8chan and 4chan, those are their friends, that's their family. They're going to sit in front of a computer, and the internet becomes real life to them, so much so that when they vent these violent fantasies on the internet, there's no one in real life, no one living with them who speaks with them on a daily basis to see something is wrong and I have to intervene here. There still are people like that. We just don't hear about them. Here's a great clip from my friend and former colleague Patrick Coffin. He posted a video recently, Five Things That Prevent Mass Shooters. And he talks about this very thing, about having people in your life who can spot when you or someone else is vulnerable and prone to violence and getting that person the help that they need.
A family environment that's affirming while disciplining and challenging is very likely to prevent the raising of a mass shooter. Families like this listen to one another. They notice when things are going well or going wrong. This alone is a potential red flag event that could prevent a murder spree. I'll give you one explicit example. Just this past weekend, a Texas grandmother averted a mass shooting by bringing her grandson to the hospital because she noticed signs. The news story didn't say where the father was or the mother was, and you've never heard of William Patrick Williams because his attentive grandmother alerted the authorities and he didn't become a shooter.
But here's the problem. We don't have these people, and not just people. We can debate this. I've had people online debate me about this. I believe in common sense proposals to keep guns out of the hands of people who are clearly violent and disturbed. Now, how do we do that? You know, there's discussion about red flag laws. At the very least, if you own a gun, you should safely lock it up so other people can't get a hold of that. That should just be a very basic thing that anybody on this issue can agree. You should treat a gun safely and keep it in a safe place. That's something we should all agree with. But at the very least, if you know people who are psychologically disturbed, keeping guns out of their hands, or if you know they're disturbed and they're trying to get weapons, to be able to find help for them. But here's the problem. We lack the social structures, people in our lives to help to get that help. And then we put forward things that act as a contagion or a virus, that the constant drumbeat 24-hour news cycle talking about mass shootings in and of itself causes mass shootings. I mean, think about it. It was no coincidence that you had the shooting at the Garlic Festival in Gilroy, then the shooting at Walmart, then the next day the shooting in Dayton, Ohio, then you've got other people walking around with guns making threats. It's the same thing as suicide contagion. When the news reports about a famous person ending their own life through suicide, other people are more likely to commit suicide. The same thing happens to mass shootings. In fact, there's an article on National Public Radio by Ritu Chatterjee called Mass Shootings Can Be Contagious, Research Shows. We've known this for a long time. And here's an audio clip of the article where one of the researchers talks about how they looked at these mass shootings and then compared it to the news cycle and saw what happens when these mass shootings are shared on internet and on social media more and more.
What we found was that for the mass killings, so these are high profile mass killings where there's at least four people killed, there was significant evidence of contagion. And we also found significant evidence of contagion in the school shootings.
Tawa says the contagion spreads through heightened media coverage of these events. News of one mass shooting tends to spark more shootings.
So one happens and you see another few happen right after that.
That's Jillian Peterson, a criminologist at Hamline University in Minnesota. Peterson says the mass shooting contagion is somewhat like a suicide contagion. That's when news reports of a high-profile suicide cause more people to take their own lives. In fact, she says a majority of mass shooters actually start out feeling suicidal.
We can show about 80% were actively suicidal prior to the shooting.
She has interviewed shooters who are now in prison and people who knew past perpetrators well. And she's come to think of mass shootings as a form of suicide.
These are people that when we talk about gun control and gun violence, I think it's important to talk about guns, how to make guns safer so that they only shoot people that need to be shot, frankly. That if people are endangering the lives of others, sometimes lethal force is necessary. But I worry that sometimes we focus so much on guns, we forget about the people behind the gun who's pulling the trigger. And seeing that that can be one of the places that we overlook, that we can actually act on in our own lives to prevent gun violence. According to the Wikipedia article on the Dayton shooter in Dayton, Ohio, which took place one day after the shooting in El Paso, it says in the hours before he opened fire in Dayton, the shooter in Dayton, Ohio, quote unquote, liked posts in favor of gun control and several concerning the 2019 El Paso shooting, including a tweet that called the El Paso shooter a terrorist and a white supremacist. And so the Dayton shooter, his motives are very different from the El Paso shooter. And you find the motives when you look at all these different past shooters, people who've committed these acts of violence, their motives differ, but I think there's a commonality. So people are hurting inside, they have some kind of mental illness or they're unwell. And at the very core of who they are, they just want to be validated. They're hurting. They want the pain to stop. And sometimes when we hurt inside, a way that we want to get that hurt out of us is to hurt others. And that is incredibly sad when that happens. And it's sad when people try to hurt others with weapons that can cause so much destruction. So I think what's important is that we need to continue this conversation about gun violence, about mental illness, about protecting society, and we have to do it in a way that's respectful to people, to not take extreme positions and just write off people that disagree with us, but try to look towards practical and sometimes solutions we don't think of as much, like reducing media coverage of these events, not just in failing to name the shooter. I think that's good we don't name the shooter, but I don't think the shooters care. They at least know, at least what I did, people will know about it. And I think that that is a huge problem. And finally, at the very least, so we should provide social support. Keep an eye out for friends and family who you're worried about them. Reach out to them. Don't just ignore them. Even if it's someone on social media, say, hey, let's talk about this on email or by phone. For this person to have a real human interaction with another person, because I think that's deep down what they crave. And when they don't have that, they want to lash out at other human beings. But at the very least, I hate when people say thoughts and prayers don't do anything. Sometimes at the end of the day, we can't stop all the bad things that happen in this world. And we should not let that cause us despair, because God has ultimately given us the victory. It doesn't mean we should sit back and do nothing. But what it means is that God loves us so much, he wants to make us be a part of his plan to redeem this world. So that when we pray for the souls of those who have died, whether it's a perpetrator or a victim of a mass shooting, to pray for the repose of their soul. That has real effects. When we pray for survivors, pray for the wounded who will carry these injuries maybe through their whole lives, that can have real effects in how God can comfort these people who may experience disability and injury for the rest of their lives. Praying for survivors, people who have lost loved ones to violence, for God to console their hearts and to draw them near to Him in their hour of need, that our prayers really do make effect. So we should never think, oh, it's just prayer. It is never just prayer. But at the same time, God makes us real causes both in how we pray for others and how we choose to act, and even how we choose to vote, how we choose as a society to live in a more sane and civilized society for the good of others. And we may disagree about how to get there. You may disagree with me with some of the proposals that I've outlined in this episode. And you know what? That's okay. But what's not okay is throwing up the walls, saying we're not going to talk to each other. They're the enemies. We're the good guys. That's not how we move forward to make our world a safer and more peaceful place. I hope that at the very least, you will carry that attitude with you from this episode, that we can go forward and pray for an end of violence against all people, no matter who they are, how old they are, where they live, so that we can continue to make our world a place where Jesus Christ, the Prince of Peace, can truly reign. So I'm so glad you're with me for this episode of the Council of Trent podcast, and I hope that you have a very blessed day.
If you like today's episode, become a premium subscriber at our Patreon page and get access to member-only content. For more information, visit TrentHornPodcast.com.